Everyone, and thank you for joining us at another episode of Lit Publishing's podcast, Lit Radio. My name is Miro, and as always, I will be your host for today's show. With me today is author of Wake Up and Smell the Coffee, Simon McCrory. How are you today, Simon?
I'm pretty good, Miro.
It's great to have you here on a rather lovely Friday at the Lit Publishing offices, and it's great to have you on the podcast.
Good. I'm looking forward to it.
Great. And of course, for our audience, Simon is the founder and CEO of The Odd Company, the organizational and diagnostics company. For those who are interested for what that stands for, a team effectiveness specialist organization providing a cloud-based team effectiveness platform and methodology designed to be self-service for team leaders. And we're very happy to have him today on the podcast to talk about Wake Up and Smell the Coffee. But before we get into the book, Simon, the question I always ask any author that comes on is, what actually inspired you to start writing? What was the story behind it?
Gosh, I don't think I thought of myself as an author when I sat down to write this particular book. This was born more out of my desire and need to write about teams. I spent the last 5-6 years of my life working solely actually on teamwork within organizations, working with large-scale organizations, working with CEOs to help them develop their teams, working on the development of team strategies. And I think over that period of time, I became more and more aware of the need for greater strategy within organizations and how they approach and work with teams. There is this assumption that if you put a group of people together and call them a team, they are going to work and it's going to happen.
Right, right.
And actually, that isn't what actually takes place. There's a lot of hard work required, a lot of effort. And I wanted to put down on paper how I understood it and how I saw it. And I have the privilege, I think, of having worked with so many large-scale blue-chip organizations, not just in the UK, but in Ireland, in the US, and even further afield in the Middle East and in Africa. And I felt I had something to say. And I suppose a little bit, and it's reflected in the title of the book, is that at times I get a little bit frustrated when I'm working with the clients because sometimes they just don't seem to grasp the importance of teams. So Wake Up and Smell the Coffee, I suppose, is that expression of my frustration at times. And I wanted to put down on paper what it was I understood and how I believed teams could be far more effective with not a lot of effort, but with a structured approach.
Right, absolutely. And just out of curiosity, are you a fan of coffee, or is it just the phrase itself that attracted you to the title?
I think it would be fair to say that I am actually not a fan, but an addict of coffee.
Right.
Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, I drink probably 10 to 15 cups of coffee per day.
Wow, impressive. And do you have any, perhaps, one recommendation for our listeners to try a new blend, perhaps?
No, because I think coffee is a little bit like wine or beer or anything else. It's your taste and what you like. I drink incredibly strong coffee.
Great.
So, yeah, it's entirely a person's personal choice.
Great. Well, let's get into the book and the themes and ideas behind it, because there's a lot I want us to unpack and go through. And the first kind of question is that the deconstruction of the traditional workplace hierarchy and, in a way, the abandonment of the performance appraisals has been echoed throughout the millennial workplace. It's something which has been great and has been implemented in many different ways in many different teams. Why has it happened, and what are the main factors behind this change?
The world of work is changing quite dramatically as the last number of years have gone by. And I suppose a little bit like technology, the pace of advancement of this change is actually quite frightening. So we saw the beginnings of the abandonment of performance appraisal as opposed to performance management. A performance appraisal, which is a retrograde process which looks back on how you've done something over a period of 12 months. You know, for the last 15 years I've been writing about this as being absolute nonsense and a complete waste of people's time. And eventually organizations began to wake up and, I suppose, smell the coffee about it and realize that actually performance appraisal, looking at somebody's performance over 12 months, really doesn't make an awful lot of sense. So the goals set in January, how relevant are they come December? The world changes far too quickly
these days.
So you need to be looking forward, not backwards. And performance management, as it's correctly practiced, is a forward-looking process. It looks at what's going to happen in the next 3 months and what it is you need to do and what it is you need in terms of support and what are the things you need to achieve. And it's kind of an incremental process over a period of 12, 24, 36, and even further. You can actually be much more effective in how you do that. I think also what's happened is that people began to realize that they were spending so much time on having meetings behind closed doors, trying to understand if they had this performance appraisal network of scores correctly apportioned in normal distribution terms, and they would then spend hours and hours behind the doors. I think it was actually Deloitte's who determined that they were spending something like 2 million hours a year talking about their people behind closed doors. And they thought to themselves, well, what would happen if we were actually to spend that 2 million hours speaking to them directly, which is what they actually want. So you have this movement happening in the marketplace where performance appraisal was beginning to be recognized as just not working and something new had to happen. So lots of people were running from it, but nobody was quite sure where they were running to. And that was the other challenge. But you had some big organizations, Deloitte, I think we saw Medtronic, Microsoft. There was a whole range of companies right across the spectrum beginning to make changes here. And this was really quite exciting. But as those companies in the Fortune 500 began to adopt this as a new idea, more and more people follow them. So you get this exponential rise in the abandonment of performance appraisal and the move to something new. But nobody seemed to know what the new was. But what was emerging very quickly in all of that was the need for team-based assessment as opposed to individual assessment. And how would you merge the two together and come up with a more comprehensive, holistic approach to understanding people's performance within the workplace? So the big holy grail of performance management, as we say, going forward to the moment, at the moment, is to find something to do with team-based assessment and how you link that to the individual performance. And I think that's a pretty critical area. When you take that happening and this move towards understanding why would we want team-based assessment, because the organization began to realize that probably 90% of what we're doing in an organization today is based on collaborative effort. So teams are an imperative of the workplace. They're absolutely essential to output, customer satisfaction, to quality. And yet we didn't seem to be doing much with them. We didn't seem to be paying the attention we needed to pay to them. You had a whole group of new people coming into the workplace. So you speak about the millennials. They're just one of the factors that drive the changes that are happening at the moment. But also the rise of the gig economy. So people now working on projects, coming in as freelancers into organizations. So how are you going to actually bring these people in such a way that they would become productive immediately, that they would have maybe able to make a contribution immediately, that they would be able to align to the corporate culture of the organization, that they would be able to work in terms of how the organization needs them to work, how their productivity would be maintained, and then most importantly, when they left, were they going to speak about you? Would they go out and destroy your employer brand, for example? Because they can do that as much as quickly as they can endorse it. So again, we began to see there was a need to change the way we were organizing the workplace. So we were bringing forward the idea that teams might be more effective in terms of absorbing the gears at a more local level into the organization, getting them productive, getting them settled in quickly and brought into how things are done in this organization. Because for me, the description of culture in any organization is simply, in the simplest definition of it for me, is it's how we do things around here. Now, I can't know about that if I'm coming from outside your organization. You've got to tell me and you've got to get me to embrace it and get me engaged with it. So this idea that we had giggers coming through the marketplace who are going to drive a different dynamic. And there were if you don't access the gigger market now, and it's rising again exponentially, I'm sorry to use that word again, but it is rising exponentially. And at the moment, 16% of the UK workforce is actually gigger based. That, they believe, in the next 10 years could be as high as 50% as the nature of work changes. And it's more about bringing together expertise to deliver a project, disbanding, and then moving on again to the next project. Excuse me. So we have a drive coming from the gig economy. The millennials come to the place of work in an entirely different way. They just see the world very differently. The millennials were born after 1980, so it's that group of people. They're about to be replaced by, of course, a subsequent generation who are now coming in into the workplace, but only beginning to come in. But the millennials are quite important. They'll dominate the workplace by 2025. They will be 75% of the workplace by 2025. But they see the world very differently to the baby boomers, people like me. We were brought up in the environment of hierarchy and power, upward surges of power. The ultimate ambition was the corner office, the team that you directed from afar. And it was a case of do as I tell, not as I do. And all of those dynamics. The millennials, they see the world differently in the sense that they want to have a more collaborative working environment. They want to be part of a team where the team leader is co-located with them. They respect knowledge and expertise, not power and hierarchy. They want ideas. They want to work in different projects on a more continuous basis rather than the same team forever. They don't expect to spend their lives in one organization. When I was growing up, the expectation was you had a career for life and a job for life. And the two were more or less one and the same thing. Then it became you didn't have a job for life. Now you don't even have a career for life. And the idea is that you learn as you go along and you absorb the new skills. But this can only happen if you're getting the experience, if you're getting the opportunity to move through different teams, learn to different ideas. So the millennial is very much aware of their own brand as much as they're aware of the employer brand. So they want to develop both. They are loyal to the organization from the point of view of the brand, but their loyalty to their own brand probably supersedes that today. And they're looking for opportunities to make themselves more marketable as they move forward. And the only way you can meet the needs of a millennial, in my mind, is through teaming networks and through a position in the organization where they can get the opportunity to move across different teams, experience different work situations and projects, where they have a team leader who is looking at them very differently, who sees themselves in the inverted hierarchy, that their job is to support the team, not the team to support the leader, which was the old way of looking at it. That I will get coaching and mentoring, not supervision and direction. That I will get an opportunity for regular feedback. I mean, let's face it, I will openly admit, I struggle with social media. I mean, I suppose I'm a Philistine in that respect, a Luddite in many regards. But the world of the Internet of Things, the immediacy of information, the immediacy of feedback that people crave today is also extended now into the workplace. So as an individual, a millennial wants feedback now, not in 12 months' time. Sure, they're not remotely interested. What are you talking about? Sure, I can't remember last month, never mind 12 months ago. They want it now. They want it more often. They want it more informally, but they want it. People do not reject feedback. People want feedback. They constantly want to know what they're doing, how they're doing it. Are they doing it in the right way? Can they do it better? What can they do to make themselves better? They need that feedback, but they need it now and they demand it now on an ongoing basis. So all of this has driven a big change in how we need to understand the world of work. It has definitely to say to ourselves that the traditional hierarchy, this very stepped process down through an organization of power and authority, is no longer the way to go. It's not efficient. It doesn't lead to agile workforces. It doesn't lead to agile responses. And particularly for those involved in the technology or the gaming industry or internet-related industries, the speed at which they move means you have to have that agile response. You have to be able to disband the team, put another team together. You have to be able to bring in different skill sets as you require them. So you have to change the way you actually conceptualize the organization. So rather than vertical, we need to think horizontally about the organization. And the organization has always been a network of teams, by the way, but we've never recognized it. And now we need to look at it more as a flatter structure where the teams interact, the teams connect in a horizontal fashion rather than this traditional vertical fashion. And that's really what's driving the changes for this world of work of ours.
Great, there's a lot to unpack there. And I want to touch on the aspect of what technology plays. But before that, I want to follow up on something you said about the whole idea of appraisal and a 12-month period and all of that. And then the fact that teams are essential. They are what drive the organizations. But there is something there which I want to sort of go into a bit more detail, and that's the individual within the team. How can we, in a more effective way, then give the right feedback and then obviously the right reward and everything that comes with it to the individual within the team? How do we then grade individual performance?
Okay, you're asking the $64,000 question that everybody else is asking at the moment. Yeah. And it is a challenge, and there's no easy answer. I'm not proposing for a moment that there's an easy answer. But I think we have to rethink how we understand reward, how we understand performance within an organizational context. And I think we have to understand, yes, there is an individual element for sure, and that's something that we can understand and we can rate and we can understand and we can... If we are looking at it in the context that I suggest, which is over 12 months going forward rather than 12 months going back, well, then we can help that person improve and see what improvements are taking place. And we can rate them accordingly if we want to use a rating scale. Some people are abandoning even the rating scale at this point in time. But when it comes to, do you give them the promotion? Do you give them the extra money, the bonus? You know, how is all that constructed? I think that's part of what you're really asking me in terms of
in a way.
There has to be an element of it which is attributable to the individual, but there has to be an element of it which relates to the performance of the team overall. So if the team is performing, so I'll give you a good example, and I come across this quite often in organizations. So I go in and I look at a particular team that isn't performing particularly well. It's not delivering what it's supposed to deliver, or it's struggling to deliver. And then you look at the individual performance reviews, and they're all being graded at 5. They're
pretty
all
good,
outstanding performers. How can that possibly be if the team is failing? So it's that contradiction that's there that we have to begin to marry off. So there are ways in which it can be done. We look at the overall performance of a team. We can judge that through various different instruments that we have available to us. My own instrument, TDP, is an example of how we use that. I know we'll maybe talk about that a little later. But we can correlate the output of a team measurement with individual performance scores. We can correlate it with financial performance of the team. We can correlate it with any given metric, you name it. These things can be correlated together to give us an understanding of what determines the success of the team. And if the team is successful, the likelihood is that the individuals are being successful as well. But in this environment where we begin to try and construct a reward process around the team, we've got to understand that the team now is more important than the individual, because quite evidently, an individual will do so much, but a group of individuals working well together can do so much more.
We'll always do more, yeah.
And not only that, but they drive each other on. So there is a need to say, well, yes, the individual has made a good contribution to what's been happening, but also they couldn't have made it without the other members of the team. So why should they get all the reward and the rest of the team get nothing? So we've got to think about how we construct this new reward structure around the teams, how we give equal attribute equally to the team performance as much as the individual performance. It's doable. I'm not saying it's easy, and it will work in some situations and maybe not so much in others. But it also relates to the fact of whether you believe that teams are important in your organization. Because remember, the message you put out about your organization, if you only reward individual effort, if you only have a learning and development function that is geared towards supporting individuals, if promotion is always based on the individual performance and on technical competence, well, then what does that say about teams? They're not actually that important. And I have seen so many times individuals, I call it the Peter Principle, which I'm sure people are familiar with, promoted to their own level of incompetence because they are seen as technically competent. So they're, oh, you run the team. But they couldn't, you shouldn't put them behind an orange box in most cases.
Right.
They're not a team leader. And that set of skills is not naturally there for everybody, so it has to be developed. So where's the L&D function that develops those leadership skills specifically to lead teams, not as part of an overall kind of general leadership sport, you know, development program, which tends to focus more on the business aspects of managing a business rather than on the what maybe some people call the softer skills. But I believe these skills now are no longer to be backtracked into the softer environment. They have to be up to the forefront now. They have to be right out there. We've got to develop our leaders to manage our teams. And managing a team in a traditional context, so a traditional, what we call a traditional co-located work team, that's one thing. Managing a virtual team is an entirely different business. And we tend to put people who've managed traditional teams now today into managing the virtual team and assume that it's the same thing. And it isn't. You've got to develop them differently. So we've got to send the right message from the organization that teams matter, that team performance matters, and that's an integrated strategy. If we continuously focus on the individual, we will never get to the point where we see teams as equally important as the individual. And in some cases, they're more important.
Great. And let's build on that, because I want to talk a bit about technology and the role it plays in evolving the world of team development and team management. You briefly touched upon that when it comes to virtual teams, remote working, and the idea of working from home, which is now, I think, especially in the UK, become a very popular alternative, and a lot more organizations are embracing it. What role does tech play in there?
Look, tech makes things possible. So maybe 10 or 15 years ago, the lack of technology would not have allowed us to work from home as much as we can do today. So yes, tech makes things possible.
Well, I remember the old school fobs that you used to plug into your, you know, big fat laptop, and it was an absolute mess to try and work with these. And people would just say, I don't want to deal with that. I'm just going to come in anyway. There's no point.
Absolutely. Now, I mean, but technology has advanced and continues to advance. My fear of technology is simply that I think some organizations are spending money on technology in an attempt to keep up with the Joneses. Everybody has and is using Snapchat, or everybody has and is using WhatsApp, or everybody has the latest team-based software for communication. But what they haven't done is actually develop the team culture. So you're trying to use technology to do something that it is not going to be able to do because the structure you have doesn't allow it to work effectively. So technology is enabling home working, for sure. It's enabling global teams to be in the workspace today. But we make fundamental errors when it comes to the deployment of technology. So we will set up a global team, or we'll set up a remote team, or we'll set up a, what we want to call as a virtual team. We tell everybody, oh yes, we're going to have, you just have to connect on from home, and we're going to work on, we're going to have Dropbox, or we're going to have, you know, whatever one of the other mass distribution systems we can use for file transfer and file loading. And then I forget that I'm working at home through my domestic band range. So yes, I can download fantastic, but uploading is a nightmare.
Yes. Yeah.
Uploading could take me 2 days for the file that downloads in 30 seconds. So we have to take on board these issues that the technology isn't the end in its own right. We've got to get the teaming culture right. We've got to get people properly trained to manage these situations, to deal with these situations, to work with the technology. The technology enables, but it has to be enabling a teaming culture. It won't deliver if it's just put in for its own sake. And I think a lot of companies are putting it in for its own sake. And then is wondering why it doesn't work.
Yeah, absolutely. As a matter of fact, I can think of an example from my personal experience where we had a, in a previous sort of challenge of mine, we ended up employing a very big company-wide new intranet. So imagine old internal communications tools that you would want, HR functionalities, and people just kind of ended up sending cat pictures to each other, and it never really amounted to anything.
No.
But the investment in there, in terms of the business side, was ginormous. You know, it was over 6 month period for just the pilot, and at the end of it, we kind of looked at each other and said, "Well, I mean, we're not even getting anything out of it."
I mean, the spend on HR by HR on technology is rising at an enormous rate. I mean, it is absolutely phenomenal in terms of, I think I looked recently at the global value of the software market for HR related systems and products, and it's something now at about 11 billion per annum. Now, that's a substantial amount of money, if you know, and that's probably only the tip of the iceberg, to be quite honest with you. There are lots of other things you could take into that to inflate that annual spend. But what are they doing with it? Why aren't they spending an equal amount of money on reconceptualizing the organization, getting that organizational structure right, developing the teaming-based culture, building on the issues like diversity and inclusion? I mean, this is a huge topic for most organizations today, diversity and inclusion. You hear it everywhere you go.
Especially in HR, yeah, absolutely.
Everywhere. Well, no, not just in HR. I mean, it's now something that CEOs are embracing because they recognize that their workforce has to reflect their customer base if they want to connect with the customer base. And diversity and inclusion is becoming a really important element of it. But it's the inclusion piece that I feel is being missed on. I think diversity is being dealt with quite well, actually, in the marketplace. It's improving continuously as we go along. But where is the focus on inclusion? Now, team-based cultures deliver inclusion. They get people working together. They recognize the differences. They recognize the differences of opinion. They recognize that multifaceted teams, diverse teams, both in terms of gender and diversity, in terms of ethnicity, etc., they produce better results than the homogeneous team. Without a question. And we need to look now at where we take this in terms of how we build forward on it. But this over-dependency on technology for the sake of it is just not going to deliver.
Do you think that perhaps we will need to embrace the diversity of thought, which perhaps still has a long way to go?
For sure. This is where I believe inclusion wins out over diversity in some regards,
right,
is that
yeah.
The more you include people and accept that there are differences there, the more you recognize that those differences in their own right drive innovation, give you different perspectives on how things can be done. They ultimately lead to better solutions for the end user, be that the customer or an internal customer, or the external customer. This is where it needs to be. But the world of today, because our organizations are run by middle-aged white males, right? So much for diversity. When you look at the top boards of these companies across the world, I think only about 20% of them are actually women. So let's not even go to the ethnic element of it, but it's a real issue for us that if they don't begin to realize that this diversity is what's going to drive the ultimate competitive advantage, that we need to get these thought patterns in, that conflict that it generates is not a bad thing. It's not bad to have conflict in a team. In fact, the team that has no conflict is a team that's going absolutely nowhere because it's never going to innovate. But the team that has conflict but learns how to manage that conflict where it's productive for the team, they're the teams that will begin to produce much more from an organization point of view. And they'll do it much easier, by the way. They'll do it much more efficiently and effectively. And they won't be constantly struggling for delivery. They will just be a more effective team. They always are. So there is a lot to be said that the diversity is, because it's controlled by and brought in by what we call the baby boomers, and they do it more because they say it's a right thing to do and it's an ethical thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
The millennium sees it kind of as a given. I said, well, why would there be an issue? Right.
Right. Yeah.
You know, we're more interested in the inclusion piece now. How do we all get talking together? And mm-hmm. I don't have to park my views at the door when I come in. I want to express my views. I want to talk openly about how I see and feel and think about things. There's a very big difference between how the baby boomers see this world of diversity and how the millennials see it. They see diversity as an absolute given. It's why would there ever be even a discussion on it? Sure, you bring anybody and everybody in, that's not the issue. It's how then do we get the inclusiveness working? And how do we begin to respect that diversity of thought that you speak about? How do we get that more and more onto the table? How do we make that a reality for how we, as part of how we make decisions and move our organisations forward?
Great. And to follow up from that, as a matter of fact, that goes into my next question, and that would be, well, what are the biggest challenges that leaders and managers have to cope with when it comes to elevating their teams? And we've already touched upon, I guess, pretty important parts of that, but is there anything else we can add to it?
I think the problem I think there's this assumption that teams just work. I think that's the first point that people have to realize, that it takes hard work. There's an element that I have written about in the book, which is one of what I call my soapbox issues, and this idea that teamwork is fun. Now, I have a fair idea where the idea has come from, but teamwork is actually hard work. It's not fun. It takes a consistency, it takes attention to detail, it takes serious hard work over time to deliver an effective team. Now, it can be very enjoyable to work for an effective team and incredibly uncomfortable to work for a dysfunctional team, but don't confuse enjoyable with fun. It's not. So I think people make this assumption that if it isn't fun, it's not working somewhere or other.
Mm-hmm.
I think also team leaders have yet to really grasp the concept of the inverted hierarchy. And by that I mean, if I am managing a team, the only way that I can be successful is if the team is successful. And I have to understand that I am underneath the team, supporting them. I'm getting all of the stuff out of their way. My job, as the team leaders, I provide the strategy, the goals, the direction, etc. I provide the structure. I make sure we've got the right people and all the rest of it in there. But the team provide customer output. They provide satisfaction. They provide quality. I can't do that as the team leader. Because if it's the case that I'm going to do everything, I might as well just have them as an audience whilst they cheer me on while I do things, which, by the way, they're not going to do, okay? But we need to get away from this thinking about how we understand teams. We need to understand that the team has to be a holistic unit that is actually working together, that is given the power, that has the ideas that they have, they can bring to the table. They're not going to be ridiculed for those ideas. We call it psychological safety. That's not paid enough attention to in teams. I have to be able to say what I think, even if it's a silly question. I should be able to voice it, because what I found in some teams, if somebody said, well, I was going to ask that question, but I thought everybody knew the answer, so I didn't want to appear stupid by asking it. When in fact, no, everybody else wanted to ask the question as well, but nobody ever asked it.
Right.
And it's that idea of getting that engagement for the team. And I don't think leaders are doing enough about that. They are very good at saying, well, here's the team and here's what we need to do. But nobody that I've come across in recent times stops on a regular basis, regular being either monthly or quarterly, and says, forget about what we're doing. How are we doing what we're doing? Are we doing it the right way? Do we actually understand the goals the same way? Are we all clear in our roles? Because maybe we're not. Is the leadership style actually suitable for how we want to run this team? Does it need to change now and evolve? What got us to this point might not be what will get us to the next point. All these issues need to be talked about by the team, because the team will determine the best way forward for the team. They don't need outsiders to tell them that, but they need that time to be reflective, and that's not in there for organisations. The more team leaders take time to be reflective and ask the question, how are we doing what we're doing, the more effective they will become. And more quickly, they will find that they will be getting a much more inclusive environment, a much more psychologically safe environment. And actually, that's mainly what my book is about. The third part of the book is all about how you ask the questions, how you have this reflection, how you take time to think about it. And I'm not talking about a lot of time. I mean, for a traditional team, and I mean by a traditional team, you know, your HR team or your finance team or your sales team even, they would need to meet, in my view, as a minimum once a quarter for about 3 to 4 hours. And that's not a huge imposition on time to address these issues for a massive benefit that will derive from it. But they've got to manage it. They've got to monitor it. They've got to measure it. They've got to decide on actions they're going to take, they're going to do to improve what it is they've identified or challenges to them. And then they check to see, has it happened? and they move on to the next issue that's emerging from the team, because these things are never static. There's no ultimate position for the team. They will constantly move through a cycle of this needs to be addressed, that needs to be addressed. Oh, that was working before. It's not working so much anymore. It's that reflection time. That's one of the key things that will allow a team leader elevate their team, in the term that you would use. For me, I use the term will drive effectiveness of the team by anything up to 20-25%. And that relates to productivity. And just think about the impact in any given organization. If every team simply improved their performance and their effectiveness by 5%, the impact to the bottom line of the organization. If those teams turned in 10, 15, 20%, or an average 10 or 15%, allowing for some really excelling and some not maybe getting the picture, think of the impact it would have. And that can be achieved by simply getting the teams in a structured way to reflect on how they do what they do, not just what they do.
Ryan, absolutely. And as we touched upon briefly on the team diagnostic profiler, can you perhaps give us an overview of what it is and maybe an example of it in action and how it works?
TDP, the Team Diagnostic Profiler, is a online cloud-based system which is at its heart a series of 12 questions that teams respond to on a scale of 1 to 7. So very simply, they seem like very simple questions, but actually they're quite powerful. So question one question, for example, would be, on a 7-point scale, the goals of this team are not clear to me. The goals of this team are clear to me. Now, you might think that's a very basic question to ask. You'll be so surprised what kind of response you will get to that statement when it's put in front of a group of people. So the individuals answer online. They answer anonymously, so nobody's identified. But what I find in most cases is people put their hand up and say, oh, well, actually, I answered two to that question, by the way. Okay, so they're not afraid to talk about it.
Yeah.
But we do it anonymously, just to keep people comfortable with it. The team leader controls the issue of that questionnaire to the team. The team leader can monitor the response rates, not by name, but by number. So if you've got 7 in the team, you can see I have 5 in, I've got 2 to go. They then close it, generate the report, and they access the online resource center that we've built behind the product. This is all the information they need to carry out the debrief with the team and the discussion that needs to now happen. So we have what's called a TDP analysis worksheet, and it takes each of the 12 questions that have been asked of the team, and then they are asked to transfer their score in various different ways from the report, which is about a 6-page report, across to this document. And then they have to answer 3 questions. And they're very simple questions. We've written them this way deliberately because I don't like to use exclusive language when I can avoid it. So their goal clarity, let's assume they've all answered 7 in terms of goal clarity on this particular. So it would appear the team has goal clarity. The question is, what have you got? The first question is, what have you got? And so they have to talk about what they mean by goal clarity. Invariably, what I find in that conversation is, yes, they're all clear, but they're all clear on different things.
Okay. Right.
So what we've got is not necessarily goal clarity. What we've got is clarity on lots of things.
On some things.
On some things, but we tend not. But if we don't have goal clarity, much else of what the team needs to do is now not possible to address, because we've got to know what we're doing first.
It's being pulled in different directions. Yeah,
we've got to know where we're going in order to determine what's the best way to get there. The next question they will ask themselves on that particular thing, well, what have we got? Why have we got it that way? What is it that has got us in that particular situation? If it is, we have fantastic goal clarity, we need to understand why we have it so we can maintain it. But if we don't have it, what are we going to do is the next question. What are we going to do about it? So 3 questions. What have you got? Why have you got it? And what are you going to do about it? Now, any team can answer those 3 questions. You do not need massive amount of facilitators, external experts to come in and sit with you to answer those questions. You really don't. It's about having a reasoned adult conversation and understanding that not everybody sees this thing the same way. Well, why? And how do we address that? And how we maintain that goal clarity going forward? So they set a series of actions that they want to achieve over a period of time. Maybe they will do it over a month or 2 months, and then they remeasure using TDP again. And now see what's happened to the goal clarity. Ask yourself the 3 questions again. What have you got? Why have you got it? And what are you going to do about it? And then you see, well, we're going to keep it this way now because it works, whatever it may be. And a good example of that was a team I was working with in New York, and they had some issues with their goal clarity. They didn't think they had. And then their reaction initially of the team was to me, the team said, well, no, we didn't answer the question the same way. Some people were talking about team goals. Some people were talking about the organizational goals. Some people were talking about the client goals. We need to do it again. We need to redefine the question and take the questionnaire again. I said, no, guys, think about what you've just said to me. People are interpreting goals differently. What's wrong with, it says it very clearly in the statement The goals of this team are not clear or are clear to me. Which bit of that English did you not quite understand?
Okay. Yeah, straightforward.
Right, that was really straightforward. So the issue here is that people are interpreting goals differently. So you need to talk about that. You need to talk about why they see it differently. And then if you get that to that point and understand that, you can decide what you're going to do about it. So they went back to have the conversation. And what normally happens is I facilitate them in the room. They forget about me completely. And I overhear these conversations going on in the groups. And one of them turned, I heard the leader turning around and saying, you know what? We thought we were bloody good at what we did. Imagine if we can fix this bit, how bloody great we'll be, right? And so they were literally beginning to understand that simple things were holding them back and creating holes in it. They decided that what they were going to do as an outcome of that particular question, it's only one of 12 now, remember, they would then sit down, the team leader was going to sit down with everybody, redefine their roles and their goals in terms of their position within the team, write an overall set of goals for the team, put it on the wall. They were an advertising agency, this particular group, or within an advertising agency. And the account manager in the middle of all of this stood up and said, well, how about if I came in on a Friday evening, after a Friday afternoon, doesn't matter who's here, inform, we have a cup of coffee and I'll tell you what's happening at the client site on the basis of all the work you're doing. Would that help? And they said, oh, that'd be fantastic. So they began to formulate these strategies for themselves to keep themselves better attuned to what the goals were, how successful those girls were in delivering the client requirements. They set up a whole very simple things. No consultants needed, no experts required. They made the decision about themselves, about what they needed and what would work for them. Now, no experts such as myself could have given them those answers. I wouldn't have them within me. In fact, in most cases when I work with teams, I have no idea what they do, right? It's not my job. My job is to make sure they have a methodology working with TDP that allows them to have the discussion that they then self-determine what's the right thing to do. No magic formulas, no silver bullets, and not telling anybody what to do. So that is what TDP philosophy is all about. It's about creating a structured conversation for that team, for them to make decisions, not for anybody else to impose decisions upon them. And that's why we call it self-serve.
Great, fascinating stuff there, and a lot for our audience to think about. And the last question I want to ask you, Simon, is actually the one I ask anyone that comes on the podcast. It is our staple, and that's, what are you currently reading?
Right. I am an avid reader. I'm not bragging. I read 2 to 3 books every week.
Every week?
Every week.
Wow.
And that's aside from the academic articles that I read, and aside from the thesis that I have to read for my students that I supervise in their PhD work and so on and so forth. So I read continuously. I'm also a speed reader, so I have that advantage. I read an amazingly eclectic range of books that I don't know how it happens, but I pick up stuff. Right now I'm on a track of history I'm reading. I've just finished reading about Vespasian, the Roman emperor, and how he rose through the ranks. And I've just started now on a series of books about the arrival of the Norse and the Danes in England back in the 700s and 800s. What people mistakenly often call Vikings. They never use that word themselves. They went to Viking, which is a different issue. But what's fascinating about the book on two levels. One is it's a series of historical novels, fictional novels, obviously. But a lot of it is based on fact. So learning about the different kingdoms of the England of that time, which of course there was no concept of England at that stage, learning about the colonization of the Isle of Man, learning about the colonization of Anglesey, and of how they created the words and names that are with us today, like Windermere, which is one of the areas that the Norse and Danes colonized, which the book is actually based upon. The name Windermere comes from two words in their language. One was Winder, was a man. And he was particularly taken by the lake when he found it. And it became known to them as Winder's Mar, which is Winder Sea, basically. So it became known as Winder's Mere.
Makes sense.
Right. That's why, and it's, yeah, the name is stuck till today. So I find that fascinating when I read that, those kind of facts, and I really love it. And I've read loads of novels of that type. But what's really intriguing about this novel, and it's just coincidental, is the main character, the hero of the series of books, is the Jarl Dragonheart. But his leadership style is fascinating. And the way it's described in the book, I don't know whether the author, I think his name is Griff Hostner, I don't know whether he knows or knew what he was writing about in terms of the team leadership skills. But this man is 100% in thinking in the inverted hierarchy. He's brought his old sworn together, and they are a very effective unit to, and work together, whereas many of the other people they fight against were all individuals in terms of how they approached it. They win most battles because they are a united group. And there were small groups, by the way, back then. They didn't fight in groups of much more than 15 or 20 people in a lot of times. He's democratic in the way he seeks advice. He allocates responsibility. He supports his people. He only gives the jobs to people who are skilled in what they do. So he's got his people who've become scouts. He's got his people who are great sailors, great captains of his ships. He has it all understood in the most amazing way. And I keep reading going, that should be in the book. That should be in the book. I should put that in the book. This man is the example
be
of
like
the
Vikings.
Perfect leader, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. What is the name of the first book in the series for our audience? So maybe they can go and pick it up.
Gosh, I'm on book 7. I'd have to go back and look it up for you. It's the Jarl. It's Dragonheart series.
Okay, well, Dragon there you Heart go. Series, yeah. Well, for our audience, in the description below, we'll put a few links where you can go and you can check it out yourselves,
yeah,
and hopefully
it,
have a good
it,
time.
Right? Yeah.
Great, fascinating.
So
and
I do read things that are non-academic, and I do read things that are, you know, as I say, eclectic and off the wall.
Yeah, great stuff. And with that, Simon, I'd like to thank you very much for joining us today on the podcast. It's been a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you, Miro, and thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today.
Great, absolutely. And of course, for our audience, if you enjoyed our conversation today, there will be links in the description below where you can find out more about the book, Wake Up and Smell the Coffee, and of course, Simon and his team at The Odd Company and social media profiles. So reach out at us as well at Lid Radio. We love to hear your feedback on every episode. And as always, I would like to thank you very much for joining us. It's always our pleasure and our honor to have you here with us each week on this journey. We look forward to seeing you next week.